So this is how the next 12 hours are shaping up for me. I get to do Coast to Coast tonight. Two cool topics. We'll be talking about the movie Knowing here in the first hour. And then coming up, we'll get to the true story, the new evidence behind the Kensington Rune Stones. Rune Stone. Just one of them for now. They'll be looking for more. We'll tell you about this Kensington Rune Stone and how it was originally dismissed as a hoax, but now has proven, I think, with a high degree of certainty, proven to be authentic. What is the Kensington Rune Stone? What was it saying? And what are the implications of its very existence? We'll talk to the guy who has, I believe, made a fairly ironclad case for the authenticity of the Kensington Rune Stone, discovered not too far from where I'm sitting right now as we're doing Coast to Coast AM. And then also, after I do that show, then I like take a quick shower and run off and do my regular local morning show, which I do here in the Twin Cities. And then after that, I get collared up and I go to a church meeting, which makes me officially the luckiest man on the planet. I love being on the radio. I just totally love everything I get to do. I couldn't be more excited about it. And I think you're going to absolutely love this story of the Kensington Runestone, both the story of its discovery and its journey into authenticity, and then also the possibility that it was laid here in the 14th century in the upper Midwest by the Knights Templar. And I know that may sound like a stretch until you hear Scott Wolter make his case coming up starting next hour on Coast to Coast. In the meantime, let's get started with kids with mammoth leg issues, teens with mammoth brain issues, and we'll shed some light on vampires next when we do crypto news to get us started on a special Sunday night on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. I was thinking about the movie Knowing over the weekend, knowing that it had gotten such terrible reviews last weekend and still was the number one movie in the box office. And knowing that I really liked Knowing, I thought it was a total coast-to-coast movie. I was watching to see how well it did with the big new movie releases coming up. And it hung in there at number three. Knowing with Nicolas Cage is, I think, evidence of just how pervasive these coast-to-coast conversations are getting that we've been having over the last couple of decades here on this radio show, and how easy it is for some people to really be able to relate to that plot, and how difficult it is for other people still to feel like they even understand what's going on. So it really was one of those sort of movies where people either watched it and either got it and enjoyed it or didn't have any idea what was happening or why. But I thought it was cool. And if you haven't seen it yet, I'd recommend it. We'll talk about it a little bit with a guy who knows something about the main themes in the movie Knowing, which made $14.7 million over the weekend for a total now of $46 million, which has to be the best performing Nicolas Cage movie. Well, I guess he did well with National Treasure 2, but there have been a few dogs in the meantime. Anyway, speaking of dogs, this morning I spent about 30 minutes sorting out my blog because somebody emailed and said they couldn't get the photo of my dog, Jack, to come up. And I don't know what I did wrong, but just because we were talking about how human-like dog society is and how humans and dogs tend to mirror each other to a point, I will include again on my blog tonight the link to the photo of my Boston Terrier who tucks himself into his dog bed by using his front paw to pull back the cushion and then crawling in underneath it. My wife snapped this photograph the other morning, and I swear to you, we didn't pose him. And if you don't believe me, ask Jack. I'm pretty sure he has an email account somewhere. Speaking of evolving animals, Texas will no longer require educators to teach weaknesses in all scientific theories, including evolution. That kicks off crypto news tonight. This is a story from physorg.com. The requirements were approved Friday by the State Board of Education in a 13-2 vote, adopting new state science curriculum standards that will be in place. In a compromise plan, teachers will be required to have students, quote, scrutinize all sides of scientific theories. This is a move criticized by evolution proponents. The vote caps a week of impassioned debate that had scientists, teachers, and textbook publishers from around the country focused on Texas. So if there are some weird pictures in your kids' science textbooks of, you know, Jesus rounding up dinosaurs onto the ark, that might change. Soon, the shot of Jesus rounding up dinosaurs and putting them on the ark will be clearly labeled possible recreation. Or did the dinosaurs come after the ark? I'm never quite sure I can follow that model, that timeline. Either way, we know that there were woolly mammoths because three boys in southwest Michigan have turned up what has been identified as a bone from a woolly mammoth. The Herald Palladium of St. Joseph reports brothers Ethan and Evan Hogue and their cousin Sebastian O'Connor found the bone March 21st on top of soil that had been scraped from a drain in a nearby township. 9-year-old Ethan, 7-year-old Evan, and 10-year-old Sebastian regularly spent time looking for antique bottles and other items around what was once a railroad line around the edge of their family's property. But that day, the kids and a couple uncles found the bone instead. Tom Goodwin, a professor of paleobiology at Andrews University, identified it as a vertebral section from the lower back of a Jefferson's mammoth. How cool is that? And by the way, that's mammoth as in Michigan State's mammoth win over Louisville today to go to the Final Four, or Louisville, as it should be properly pronounced. I'm sweet on Louisville. But it was a good game until the stretch, and I'd like to see the Big Ten represented in the Final Four. Having known a few Spartans in my life, too, I'm quite confident that a few young college people may be overserved tonight in East Lansing listening to Coast, which reminds me, another story from PhysOrg.com. It appears that when it comes to teen brain development, parents should be more worried about alcohol abuse than pot. Two recent studies have been published showing that alcohol, a legal substance, though not legal for teens in the U.S., of course, is considered more dangerous than marijuana, which is illegal in many countries. One study looks at teen brain development for its uniqueness, as well as for the effects that substance abuse has on the brain during this time. Alcohol and marijuana are commonly used by high school students, we all know. It is little surprise that the study is interested in the brain abnormalities stemming from abuse of these substances. Now, findings from the U.S. study showing that alcohol use in teen causes more irregular brain function than marijuana would seem to square with the efforts in countries, you know, in nations like the U.K. to encourage new drug classifications. In the British journal Lancet, a professor there at Bristol University asked psychologists and scientifically or medically trained police to rank different substances according to how harmful they are. The study purports that experts rank alcohol and tobacco as more harmful than marijuana. In a list of 20 substances, alcohol came in at number 5. Tobacco came in at number 9, and pot came in at number 11. Now, in the end, I don't think the study is saying that kids should drink or get high, just how skewed it is that society seems relieved when kids go for a beer instead of a bong. And, you know, I'm working on having my kids not do either, but that having been said, as a non-drinker and a non-recreational drug user, it just seems illogical to spend so many billions of tax dollars keeping adults from doing one over the other in a free society. I still don't get it. Now, the only thing that scares me about this is that something you keep hearing on Coast to Coast, no matter how many times I say, yeah, I'm good with reforming the pot laws, somebody will call and start telling me why pot should not be illegal. Like, they don't get it. I've already said. I don't know. Anyway, that disconnect has happened like the last 5 times the subject has come up on the air, which just reinforces why I never smoke pot. I already know I'm not the brightest bulb in the box, and I don't need any help being the dumbest guy I know. By the way, the rest of the bulbs are just getting brighter. This is cool because it involves a sponsor of Coast to Coast. I saw this news story somewhere. For life of me, I couldn't find it when I went back to look for it. So sorry, I don't have an attribution for it. But C. Crane, right, introduced the new energy-efficient light bulb on Friday, calling it, quote, the best light bulb in the world. The C. Crane company launched its new Geo Bulb LED light bulb. It uses 7.5 watts to provide as much light as a 60-watt incandescent light bulb and boasts a lifespan of 30,000 hours, roughly 10 years. So you get your money back. Quote, it's best light bulb in the world. It's the most efficient and the longest lasting, said President Robert C. Crane, who's always been a good supporter of Coast to Coast, adding that the bulb could reduce worldwide energy use by 10%. Cutting energy bills in half over the next 10 years. Why don't we put some tax dollars into that and just put these bulbs up everywhere and start saving right away? Bulb is available in three color spectrums, by the way, cool, soft, and warm. While the bulb seems to hit all the energy notes, the price is comparatively high. The bulb runs about $119. Now, I tried to get Robert C. Crane on the radio tonight just to talk about it, but I couldn't find him. He was probably hanging out under his new light bulbs, being cool, soft, and warm. For $119, the light bulb should actually make you look cooler, too, while you're sitting underneath it. For $129, they should have a light bulb that makes you look studly. By the way, finally, from Boston's WCVB-TV, in a story you can find linked at coasttocoastam.com, the headmaster of one of the city's most prestigious exam schools is dealing with an unusual rumor sweeping student classrooms. There are no vampires at Boston Latin School, said headmaster Lynn Moon Tita. Actually, the headmaster sounds like a vampire. Lynn Moon Tita. Seriously, students at the school, which of course, was famously founded in 1635, began emailing news organizations Wednesday night with the strange story of vampires roaming the halls. Quote, supposedly three students believe that they are vampires, and today, when a student was bitten, the police were informed, wrote a student onto a message board at the BostonChannel.com. I heard that one girl was arrested, another suspended. Police, however, denied reports that anybody at the school was bitten. The rumors are strong enough to cause anxiety among the student body that there are vampires at the school and disrupted classes on Thursday. Well, pretty much any chance you can to disrupt classes, don't you think? Has that changed since I was in high school? Kids pretending they're up in arms about vampires just to get out of taking an exam. I seek your cooperation in redirecting your energy toward the learning objectives of the day. Wrote the representative from the Boston Latin School, headmaster Lynn Moon Tita. Please do not sensationalize or discuss these rumors. That she wrote in a note obtained by the Boston Globe. She also said she was concerned that some students' safety might be jeopardized because of the rumors. At no time was anyone's safety in jeopardy, she wrote. In its long, rich history, the school's students at Boston Latin have included revolutionary firebrands Ben Franklin, Sam Adams, John Hancock, and Lestat de Lioncourt. Hey, wait. It wasn't he, just kidding. Good thing this didn't happen in a Texas public school, though, right? They'd be having to, quote, scrutinize all sides of the vampire theory in their textbooks or something. Mark Seifer joins us. We were just talking a little earlier about the new movie Knowing, and so I asked the producers. I said, "Can you find anybody that can talk about these subjects that they bring up in the movie Knowing?" And this is who we found. Mark Seifer, thank you so much for giving us time. It says here on your website, featured in the Washington Post, Scientific American, amongst other publications, including the New York Times. So I'm sure I've read your work. Thank you for giving us some time tonight.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
Okay, now I kind of made you go see, or we asked you nicely if you would go see Knowing. What did you think of the movie, first of all?
I thought it was a great film. I thought it was super. I read the reviews, and the reviews pretty much trashed the film, I thought.
Yeah, they were awful, and the reviews were terrible. The only one that, of the major reviewers, Roger Ebert was the only one, I think, who really loved it.
Well, what you said before is right on. I remember when 2001 came out, that film got panned. And only through the years did people realize how important it was. I think this is a very important film. It's talking about the ultimate question. And I thought it was character-driven. I thought the opening sequence was incredible, starting with the satellite photo and then just moving down to the,
right.
to the arteries. And then
right.
the scene, I mean, I grew up in the 50s, and that whole scene in the beginning with the girl writing the numbers and being in that classroom in the 1950s, wow, I mean, that was super. It was just really, really good.
It was really good. And so let's talk a little bit about some of the themes without even getting into the plot of Knowing. That we're talking about some fairly broad philosophical disagreements which come up during the course of the movie, sometimes between the father character played by Nicolas Cage or by his son and or by their colleagues. And they all kind of talk about this idea of randomness in the universe versus determinism. And so I think that as movies go, you don't often come across a movie, I think, that that explicates that subject as well as Knowing did.
I think you're right. I think it really discussed exactly the problem. And really you have two different views of the universe. One is Aristotle's view, which he deals with this term called teleology. The end is implied in the beginning. And the great example is the acorn. Implied or inside the acorn is the future oak tree. So in a sense, the acorn has plans for 40 years later to be an oak tree. And that's opposed by Darwin's theory, which is survival of the fittest and random mutation. So the reason a giraffe gets a longer neck is because by just sheer chance, the one with the longer neck survive and the ones with the shorter necks die out. The cheetahs, the fastest ones live and the slower ones die out. So what happens is science is built on supposedly Darwin's theory that we're just here by pure chance. But what I think the movie is dealing with, and I think ultimately what I talk about when I teach all this, is that it's hypocritical. And that is because we all know that there are laws to the universe. Every scientist is looking for the laws to the universe. So the big question is, how can you have a law to the universe without a lawmaker? And that, I think, is really what this story ultimately is dealing with.
Yeah, and in the end, though, we might define lawmaker very differently at the end of the show, because at the end of the movie, you still don't necessarily know what creator means. I don't want to get into too many specifics of that, but even there, you have an interesting conversation throughout the movie about kind of who's the puppet master or who's the clockmaker, to use some of the classic philosophical terms.
I think you're right. I think one of the things I really liked about it was it talked about Ezekiel. And in the Bible, Ezekiel sees a flash of light come out of the sky, which many people think is UFO, and four animals come out. You know, the lion, bear, eagle,
right.
and man. And that's symbolized by the Sphinx. And so, and the film, I think, is dealing also with life and death and life after death.
Right.
It's a spiritual question. And really, it's a story of Adam and Eve, too. So I think you're right, because there is an extraterrestrial element in there. I kind of look at it, and I talk about it in Transcending the Speed of Light.
That's one of your books? Is that your first book?
My first major book was a biography of Nikola Tesla. And,
okay.
And the second one is Transcending the Speed of Light, where I talk about it starts out with the Anthropic principle, which is what a lot of physicists noticed. Arnold Sommerfeld, a very famous physicist, noticed the number 137 showing up in the structure of electrons and also the expansion rate of the universe. So you've got the microcosm and the macrocosm and the number 137 showing up. Heisenberg, Pauli, Feynman, they all looked at this number 137. They say, why is it showing up in a very small, you know, in atoms and in the giant cosmos? It doesn't make any sense, except that there's some great design underneath it all. So there is the belief that there's some design making to the structure of the universe and the importance of numbers. And of course, that shows up so amazingly in the film, the use of numbers.
Yeah, although I wouldn't call that numerology, which is, I mean, there is an interesting use of numbers. I want to get back to that coming up in just a moment. And I also want to talk then about synchronicity, because that's probably the key. That seems like the framework of so much of what the movie is hung on, is this idea, this concept of synchronicity. So let's talk about that and what it means. And if you can help us understand better why synchronicity happens. Do you want to take a stab at that coming up next?
Sure.
Okay. All right. Then thank you. Mark Seifer will hang on. Why does synchronicity happen? What does it mean when it does happen? And we'll get to that next. And then the real story behind the Kensington Rune Stone. Next hour, it'll blow you away. Coming up on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Well, Mark Seifer is right. It just seems like there's a lot of synchronicity in the world. He's written about that before. He's a visiting professor and speaks on psychology at Roger Williams University. And he is also a handwriting expert, but he studies all sorts of interesting work, including that of Nikola Tesla. And we'll talk about the movie Knowing. We're not giving anything away. You'll have to go see it if you want to go see it. If you don't want to go see it, I totally understand. Although it does have one of the coolest endings of all time, which I thought was... took enormous guts on the part of the filmmaker to end the movie the way they did. That having been said, I think it hits on so many interesting subjects, and I just had to talk about it with somebody. So Mark has been kind enough to agree to join us coming up next. And let's sort out a little bit about synchronicity as it's understood in the movie Knowing a little bit, but in general. And how is it that so many events... In popular film, for example, a movie comes out about a meteor hurling to Earth. And then 2 weeks after the movie comes out, they announce a meteor is hurtling toward Earth. How does that happen all the time? It happens so often with films that you begin to think that somehow the producers in Hollywood set this up in advance. We'll find out more about that next. On Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. So last night on Coast to Coast, we talked to a guy named Todd Tucker, who is the author of a book called Atomic America. And he had written about this unusual nuclear event that hadn't got a lot of publicity back in 1961. And it was actually America's most deadly nuclear accident, because yesterday was the 30th anniversary of the meltdown at Three Mile Island. So in talking about Three Mile Island, of course, we had to talk about the China syndrome. And here we were talking about synchronicity again. Here the movie, you know, the China syndrome comes out 2 weeks before the meltdown at Three Mile Island. And so once more, Mark Seifer, we come back to this weird kind of synchronicity. It makes me worried that that some of the events in the movie Knowing are about to take place.
I have to admit, that's why I don't watch 24.
Yeah. But tell me, let's talk about that. The idea that synchronicity, explain synchronicity for people who have never had a working definition of it.
It means meaningful coincidence, and there's many levels to it. One is telepathic. This literally happened to me 2 nights ago. I had a dream, and when I woke up, I told Lois, I said in the morning, I had a dream about an actor. You know, it was Steve McQueen, and he was chasing someone else in the dream, et cetera, et cetera. So then I get Rolling Stone magazine, and I'm reading it about 3 hours later, and it talks about that Steve McQueen has just directed a new movie, and then it says it's not the Steve McQueen you think of, it's a new guy with the same name.
Okay.
Now, here I dream about someone right. I haven't thought about in a million years, and then I think it's telepathy. I think I have ESP with the magazine coming out. That's one form of it. It's just simple ESP. But then there's another form, which you just talked about, the China syndrome. Now, one of the things about the China syndrome is that in the movie, they mention the state of Pennsylvania. And in my book, Transcending the Speed of Light, I mentioned something. It's a term I came up with. It's called the kicker. It's an extra coincidence, which just is like the icing on the cake. It's like, wow, if you don't think this is a real synchronicity,
right.
Here's something else for you. The most famous one.
And let's talk about it, because that particular line in China syndrome is something like, it's an explosion that would take out all of Pennsylvania, right? I mean, don't they make some sort of explicit explosion reference even?
Yeah, the size of Pennsylvania. So they
the size
they
of Pennsylvania,
the state where it happened.
Right.
And
there's no way. I mean, let's just establish. I mean, because this is the same thing that's happened over and over again with space movies and whatever, that we just Hollywood producers can't be that powerful. They might be able to do a lot of stuff, but there's no way they could have gotten Three Mile Island to melt down.
No, there was a couple of famous cases that I discussed. One was a book. It was called The Titan, and it was about a giant ship that hits an iceberg and sinks. And that was in 1898. The Titanic was 1912, so it was 14 years before. Same name, Titan, Titanic. And the name of the captain of the ship had the same name. So that was the kicker in that case.
Well, that's interesting. I know the Titan case. I've heard it argued that the author was sniffing around trying to find out the name of this new super ship that was being built. So I think that's interesting. I think the fact that you hit the kicker right when you have the name of the actual captain, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Now, another one was a book called Black Abductor. It was in the 1970s. It was about a girl who was kidnapped by a black revolutionary group, and she ends up joining the group, and the girl's name was Patty. A few years later, Patty Hearst gets kidnapped.
Sure.
Now, the unpredictable element there is you would have never imagined that she would have joined the group that kidnapped her. I mean,
right.
You know, it just wouldn't happen. So
the Symbionese Liberation Army?
Yes.
Right.
Yes. So what you have here is there's different levels to synchronicity. One is just ESP. Another is the predictive level, which those books and the China Syndrome predicted. But there's another level to it, too, and that is what Nostradamus was doing, and that is astrology. You know, we think of the future as completely unpredictable, but really, if you're talking about where Jupiter's going to be on January 3rd, 2014 at 7 o'clock, we know exactly where it'll be. So in terms of the future positions of the planets, everything is mapped out. There is no chance involved. And so this gets back to Aristotle's term teleology and the acorn having within it the structure of the oak tree. If nature has the future already mapped inside it, does the universe, can you go from nature to the universe? And if so, each of the planets, Jupiter, Mars, Saturn, they all have different energies. And what Nostradamus did and what any good astrologer can do is see the energies related. If Mars is opposed to Saturn, that's, you know, a tough situation. And if Jupiter is trine the sun, that's a good situation. So you can say, you know, 7.2 years from now, if Jupiter is trine the sun, you're going to expect something good to happen. And a stock market crash could be associated with Saturn in its fall. So I think
let me sort out there a little bit of that, because I'm not always on board with astrology. I actually tend to always read my horoscope the day afterward, and then I look back and find out whether it fit the day, as opposed to putting it in my thought the first thing of the day and then seeing whether or not I can conform the day to fit the horoscope. Mm-hmm. So I kind of take a very scientific approach to this, because I've always been curious about it. And I think there's a difference between astronomy and astrology. We can predict where Saturn is going to be. We can predict where Saturn is going to be in relationship to the sun. But is it really fair to say that we can predict that at 7 o'clock on a Tuesday in 2014, we're going to have a bad time or something wrong is going to happen?
Well, I'll tell you why I think there's something to it. First, okay. There is the book Cosmic Clocks, written by Michael Gocklin. He's a Frenchman. He did 20,000 horoscopes, and he found that politicians have Jupiter important in it, warriors, military people have Mars important in the horoscope, that kind of thing. In my master's thesis, which I wrote a million years ago at the University of Chicago, I did a study linking what interested me about LSD in those days was the amount of LSD it would take to put a person on a trip. It's 50 micrograms of LSD will put someone on an incredible trip for, you know, 6 or 12 hours. 50 micrograms is 50 millionths of a gram. That's like a grain of sand, you know, or a grain of salt, just a tiny, teeny little amount will alter someone's consciousness for 6 or 12 hours. What I did was I then used Newton's theory of gravity, and I figured out the gravitational attraction of the different planets on the Earth. For instance, the moon has a gravitational attraction on the Earth of, say, 1 on the tides. The sun is a half. In other words, if the moon can pull the tides at a factor of 1, the sun can pull it about half that amount. So a moon tide is 1.5 times when the moon and the sun are lined up together, and they pull the tides a lot, and you have a great big movement. Jupiter has an effect on the tides. You can do the calculations, and it's about 0.006. It's like 6 millionths of a gram. You know, it's the same level of LSD. So what I'm trying to say is that Jupiter and our brain is 85% water. So each of these planets has a geomagnetic pulse, and each of them is actually influencing our brain at a very minute amount. And you could say, well, it's so far away, it doesn't mean anything, but it's on the same level as LSD. So our brains are very, very sensitive to minute amounts. The other thing to consider, have you looked at Jupiter and Saturn through a telescope?
I mean, I've been to planetariums and done that sort of thing, but I don't know that I've done it recently.
Well, I mean, that was the one flaw I thought in that movie. I love the film. I love knowing. But when he looked through the telescope and saw Saturn's rings, they never show you Saturn's rings. I wanted to see them. But when you really look at Saturn's rings through, I have just a binoculars, 20-power binoculars. I can see Jupiter, the moons of Jupiter. They're right there. They're very close to us. By the naked eye, they look far away. But when you just look through a telescope, you realize that those planets are very, very close to us. So I think that there is something to astrology, and I think that the energies of the different planets do play a role. Gurdjieff, the Turkish mystic, felt that wars were definitely influenced by major planetary interactions. So one way or another, we certainly, you and I, and I see myself as a scientist too, but we certainly can agree that there's nothing uncertain about the future in terms of the future position of the planets.
Well, does that put you in the category of a determinist? Do you believe that all of our events are predetermined?
I think we definitely have free will. I think that whatever creator there is out there, and in the movie, it seems to be extraterrestrials. One way or another, we have free will, but within a limited domain. I mean, we all are going to be here for a period of time, and then hopefully we go to someplace else. But I mean, that's, you know, another element of
I don't want you, don't give him anything more of the movie. And I don't, and I don't think I agree with your conclusion. I don't think that is, I don't know that that's what the movie says in the end is true. I think that, I don't want to ruin it for anybody who hasn't seen it yet. So
no, I don't.
I'll leave that off there. But I think that you can make an argument for and against what you just said. Here's one of the things I've always rejected: the idea of that some people are predetermined to be successful, for example. And we get into sort of this Calvinist theology that, you know, some people it's predetermined that they will be saved, and other people, no matter how good they are, no matter how much they try, no matter the wonderful things they do for other people, it's predetermined that they are doomed. And I've always believed that's, I understand why some people think that. It's never been part of my worldview. So I'm reluctant to go down the deterministic road, but at the same time, I don't know that there isn't an element of that. I can't rule out, I don't know that anything is sort of mutually exclusive in our cosmos. Now, what I did think was interesting was and I didn't know anything about this, that the character that Nick Cage's character is named after somebody famous, and that too brings us back to synchronicity.
Yes, it's Arthur Koestler. I used to read all his books in the 1970s. He wrote a great book called Case of the Midwife Toad, which is about Camera, who's the guy who came up with the idea of synchronicity. And Camera was opposed to Darwin. Cameron believed essentially in use and disuse, that if an animal used something, you know, if the cheetah ran fast, he would tend to become faster in the next generation. But he also studied synchronicity. And Arthur Koestler also wrote a book on parapsychology and synchronicity. And he also wrote another book called Act of Creation, and another incredible book called The Sleepwalkers, which is about Newton and Kepler. And he was a very, very famous author in the 1970s. So I think, obviously, the filmmaker was paying homage to Arthur Koestler by trying to resurrect him. And I talk about him in class, too. I tell my kids, I wrote his name on the board just a couple of weeks ago. I said, you know, this is a guy no one ever reads anymore, but you should read this guy.
Right. How are the college kids reacting to that these days?
I think they're totally into it. In fact, talk about synchronicity. I was talking, I just gave a test, and my test was on Darwin, chance versus teleology versus Aristotle. That was the first essay. And then I got a call from you guys saying, do you know anything about chance versus, determinism? And it was amazing because I had literally just given a test. Let me tell you one other wild synchronicity from my point of view. When I was in grade school, when I was in kindergarten, which was in the 1950s, there was a kid in my class who never sat down and wrote numbers. That's all he did was write numbers. Here it is 50-something years later, and there's a movie about a kid who just writes all these numbers. So right. Personally, from my point of view, this is an amazing synchronicity.
No, I could totally see that. That's very interesting. I knew somebody that just wrote shapes, triangles and circles and squares, just uh-huh. over and over again. And that was how they expressed themselves in moments of stress.
Wow.
Was just writing in shapes. And I actually held on to one of those pages, and I've been waiting for just the right parapsychologist or psychologist or whomever to give it to and say, what do you see in this? Because it's almost like they're doing a kind of free writing. You know, it's almost like they're really not paying that much attention to what they're doing. Their hand is kind of doing it while they're talking on the phone or while they're doing something else. And they just, I thought, is it just random circles, squares, and triangles, or is there something that's coming out of them being expressed in those shapes?
Oh, I think that there is, and I think, you know, people give Freud short shrift, but we have a conscious and we have an unconscious. Every night we go to sleep and we dream, and this second consciousness is a much more expanded reality, and it's in touch with our creativity, it's in touch with other dimensions, and I think that this person you're talking about, their doodles, they're expressing unconscious factors, and, you know, the whole idea of sacred geometry, I think, is a subtext.
Yeah.
Of the film as well, that he's an MIT, you know, cosmologist, and Pythagoras obviously was very interested in geometry too.
Sure, sure, and Pythagoras being behind the mystery cults. In fact, coming up when we do our next guest, the Kensington Runestone has been confirmed in a very interesting way, and the sacred geometry may have a part in that as well when we get into that conversation coming up. So, again, we've been talking with Mark Seifer, who's a professor and a writer. Transcending the Speed of Light is one of his books. Knowing is the movie we were talking about, and I don't often champion a movie where I like things like Iron Man. I'm big on comic book movies, but this just seems like a movie that deserved a better review than it was getting, because
it definitely did. I think this is a very profound movie and an important film, and very remindful of Close Encounters and 2001. And I think he's a real thinker. And I thought it was
the director or the writer. I mean, you said he. Who's the?
Yeah, there was a director and a writer. They were two different people.
Right.
And so I think they worked together closely on this movie, though.
Well. You know, all of the discussions about synchronicity and chance and determinism, I don't think any of those can explain what's happening with Nicolas Cage's hair.
Uh-huh.
Through the whole movie, I'm so distracted by his hairline.
Well, I was glad that Tesla's name was mentioned in the film, and
I wanted
Nicolas Cage to play Tesla.
Oh, really? Would he be the guy to play Tesla? Why?
I think he'd be a great Tesla.
Is he just weird enough to be Tesla?
Yeah, I think so. And his hair looked a little Tesla-ic to me. And
Tesla-ic.
They mentioned Tesla's name in the movie, which was, I thought, you know, a hoot.
Well, and so I know you like to write about Tesla. Maybe we can have you back on again sometime and go down that road as well. So thank you for giving us the time that you did.
Thank
Mark
Seifer,
link up to him through coasttocoastam.com. Really enjoyed the conversation. Thank you for...
I did too. Thank you very much.
...for joining. And go see Knowing. Even if you hate it, even if you don't like it as a movie, I swear it'll give you tons of things to talk about. You have a great cup of coffee afterwards just talking about why you thought it didn't work. As many people I've spoken with since I started talking about the movie went to go see it and ended up not liking it. But you'll see what I'm talking about if you go check it out sometime. Also, coming up then next, the Kensington Rune Stone. This was dismissed as a myth, as a hoax. And I believe we can talk to somebody coming up next who has the scientific chops to say absolutely it did happen. And not only is this a real thing, but it has enormous implications for how we should be rewriting our history. Coming up next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett.